Okay, so welcome to the Sutta class. Today we're going to be looking at the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 140, one of my favorite of all suttas. This particular sutta has two parallels in Chinese, one of them being a sutta of the Majjhima Agama, Majjhima Agama number 162, and the other one being a sutta, an independent sutta in the Taisho canon. That independent sutta is quite interesting or quite unusual, translated by Zhu Qian in I think it was in about 250 or something like that, 200 or 250 AD. So it's a quite an unusually early text. The classical period for translating the Agamas and Vinayas in Chinese was around 400 to 430 AD. And there was only a relatively small number of texts translated before that time, one of which was this one. Oops, this one here. There's also a quotation that the parallel. This particular parallel is, as often in the Tibetan quotations, is not an independent sutta, but is a parallel found in a discourse quotation in Shamatadeva's Abhidharma Koshupayaka Nama Dika. Okay, so this particular sutta, as well as having beautiful Dhamma teachings, is also has one of those texts, that one of those few suttas that also has very interesting and quite moving background story. And I'll start out by reading the background story here, as retold by Bhikkhu Bodhi, based on the commentary. Pukkhusati, who's the interlocutor in this text, had been the king of Takasila. Anyone remember where Takasila is? That's where everybody learns stuff, exactly.
But where?
Where?
Up north somewhere.
Where, sorry?
Where is Austin?
No, it's a real place. Yes. It's in the northwest, yeah, Gandhara.
It's in Gandhara.
Hmm. Okay, so he'd entered into a friendship with King Bimbisara of Magadha through merchants who travelled between the two countries for the purposes of trade. Interesting, kind of historically, it's that route that we're looking at here. Is indeed the old trade route that they call the Uttarapatha. So it leads from, I think where the best map is, but leads from here, Magadha, where King Bimbisara was, up to Taxila, up here, Gandhara. And this route, so you can see just from the distribution of the place names, you can see the two main trade routes fairly easily. What they call the Uttarapatha, the northern route, goes up to the northwest from Magadha through Kosala, and Sarvati was a great centre of trade, up through Mathura, the Kuru country, and then into Gandhara, Cambodia, and then from there through to Persia on one side, and then up to the Silk Road on the other. The other great trade route was the southern road, the Dakinapata, which again led from Kosambi, because these trade routes are determined by the geology. This region here is hilly. It's all called the Dakinagiri, these days called the Deccan, and this region here is desert. So they came down here from Magadha through Kosambi down to Ujjaini, and down to this Avanti and this area here on the coast. So this coastal region here was then became the main staging route for sea trade to the west. So through to Persia, and then from there through to Rome. From there, the southern route then went down here. You can see it's labelled on this one. Dakinapata is the southern route, down to Andhra. And Andhra was the great port for the sea trade to the east. So from there through to Suvarnabhumi, Indonesia, China, and so on. But also down from there to Sri Lanka. So that the normal route to go to Sri Lanka from India, from northern India, was to come on the Dakinapata down to Andhra and then on the boat. Of course, people sometimes would travel across the land route as well, but most, no. Well, there is Rama's Bridge. It's a very famous thing. It's sea, but according to the Ramayana, then there was a land bridge built. And there's actually a thing there under the water, which some people claim to be the actual Rama's bridge. So there's a bigger image.
Every time you pointed out the route from Hara, is it through the mountains, the Deccan Mountains?
To where's that? Gandhara. Andhra.
I looked down every time you indicated it.
I'm not sure what you're saying.
I looked down every time you did your cursory towards Andhra. So you would go to the port on the west coast first to Andhra. You could not go straight down.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you might go. You might not go to the port. Yeah, so they go down to Avanti, but you're certainly fairly close to it. So here's Ajanta and Ellora. So again, a great Buddhist centre is down through there. Godavari is the stream which is mentioned in the Solasapanha as being the place where Bhavari set out from. And then Amaravati and Andhra, this is another great Buddhist centre. Nagarjuna stayed there. Two of the Mahasanghika schools were established there. Adam's Bridge. Oh, we've got Adam's Bridge, Rama's Bridge. Yeah. Also, they've got Adam's Bridge, right?
Yeah.
So, just to see if there's any good. Yeah, you can see there. There's actually almost a bridge there. So some people argue that it's actually a man-made construction underneath the water.
How long is it?
I think
it's 21.
Rama's Bridge, Rama Setu, a chain of limestone shoals between Pamban Island off the northwest coast. Geographical evidence suggests it's a former land connection between India and Sri Lanka, 18 miles long, 30 kilometres long. This cup is covered in stuff. I don't know what it is. It's covered in something.
Would you like a fresh cup?
Thank you. Yeah. Reportedly passable on foot up to the 15th century. It says that it doesn't seem that the sea level rose, but that the storms deepened the channel, so that it was worn out. was worn out by how old? It's not man-made. It's just people say it's man-made, but it's not really man-made. But it's you can see the bridge there. So they say how Rama crossed over. Something like that, yeah. Let's see, the clouds getting in the way, yes. Trying to show something of the terrain, so you can't see it that clearly here, but anyway, you can see that this is the southern route down this way, and you can see that this is much more hilly, rough kind of area around through here. So this is what tended to, I mean, it wasn't obviously wasn't completely inaccessible, but it tended to slow down the transports. This is why the trade tended to go down this way, down to the ports.
They might have bandits too.
I'm sure they would have had bandits, as they do today. And down here, to Andhra Pradesh. And yeah, similarly on this is the northern road here. And this is, of course, it's all the desert in Rajasthan. So the upshot of all that is that that King Bimbisara is down here, and King Pukusati was up there. In an exchange of gifts, Bimbisara sent Pukusati a golden plate on which he'd inscribed descriptions of the three gems and various aspects of the Dhamma. When Pukusati read the inscription, he was filled with joy and decided to renounce the world. So, this is a very interesting little passage yet. Without taking formal ordination, he shaved his hair, put on yellow robes and left the palace. He went to Rajagaha, intending to meet the Buddha, who was then in Sabati, about 300 miles away. Okay, so he came all the way from there down to Rajagaha, thinking to meet the Buddha, but the Buddha was back here in Sabati. He could have saved himself a few hundred kilometers on his trip. The Buddha saw Pukusati with his psychic powers, recognizing his capacity to obtain the paths and fruits. He journeyed alone on foot to Rajagaha to meet him. To avoid being recognized by an act of will, the Buddha caused his special physical attributes, such as the marks of the great man, to be concealed, and he appeared just like an ordinary wandering monk. Or, one might interpret it that he appeared just like an ordinary wandering monk because he just looked like an ordinary wandering monk, but anyway, that's a matter for your interpretation. He arrived at the potter's shed shortly after Pukusati had arrived there, intending to leave for Sarvati the next day in order to meet the Buddha. Okay, so that's the kind of the background to our story, and just see if I can pull this up fairly quickly to see the So this is that story is a summary of the story, which is here in the commentaries. But I'm just interested to see the name of the... It's worth translating the passage in full, but that would take us a bit too far away from our goal. I'm just looking for the... Yeah?
Ask a question.
Sure, yeah.
Regarding that plate.
Uh-huh.
Are there any other accounts of writing describing the Triple Gem during life?
Yeah, well, this is the thing. I'm not really aware of any. So they do send letters, yes. So they did have writing, it seems, but there's no accounts of actually writing down the suttas.
I took all those accounts of writing the Jatakas as being
described. No, there's no reason why they didn't have writing in the Jatakas. Yeah, the word for a letter is a leaf, and most of the time, if you look at the letters, it's just like brief messages which would be sent from one person to another, like personal things. And so there's every reason to suppose they would have had those things. Yeah, and writing would have been for... See, this actually has... let's see.
An acronym, that's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, this story has a ring of truth about it. Because for a number of reasons, I mean, we do find in the later traditions writings inscribed on gold. And gold is actually an extremely good writing material. Yeah, it's very easy to, very malleable. You can make it very thin very easily. You can write on it quite easily. It doesn't perish and all of those kinds of things. Of course, the only problem with it is people like to nick it and melt it down. But apart from that, and there's plenty of gold in those areas. Bimbisara wouldn't have had any shortage of gold, so there's no reason why he shouldn't have done that. And as a gift from one king to another, you know, is quite not an unlikely kind of gift. So
being brought up again regarding King Devanampiyatisira having such a gift.
So that's recorded of Devanampiyatisira as well, is it?
Yeah, that's what converted him to Buddhism by King
King Ashoka.
Yeah.
Oh, Ashoka sent him a. Okay. Yeah, well, could have gone either way. Could have been inspired by King Ashoka's example, or one way or the other. But anyway. I don't think it's at all implausible that it could have been done, and if it was done, and if it was interred in a stupa or something like that, then there's every possibility that it could still exist if it hasn't been dug up. So anyway, this is just giving an idea of what was actually written. So first thing it says, hi ida dhatagato loke upando araham sama sambuddho vijjan charana sampano sugato loka vidu anuttaro sapurisa dhammasarati satha deva manusanam. Buddho Bhagavati. So that's the first thing that they wrote down. Then from there they wrote down that having fulfilled the 10 paramitas, he was born in Tusi to heaven, or passed away from Tusi to heaven, got reborn in this world. And so there's a bit of a story of the Buddha's life. Then a quote from the Ratna Sutta, Yankinchi Wittang Yidhava Hurangwa. So it's sort of expanding on the Buddha's qualities, and then it goes on to the qualities of the Dhamma, listing the Bodhipakya Dhammas, starting with the four Satipatthanas and going up to the Noble Eightfold Path. Notice how it abbreviates, it expects you to know that. If you're reading this text and you don't know the Bodhipakya Dhammas, then you misinterpret this passage. But what it's saying is you start out with the four Satipatthanas and finish up with the Eightfold Path. Then another quote from the Ratna Sutta. yam buddha setho parivanna yi suching, and then through the sangha ratna supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho, and then the chula sila, majjhima sila, mahasila, so all of the three passages on sila from the Digha Nikaya, which are teaching the restraint of the six senses, mindfulness and clear comprehension, contentment with the requisites, resorting to the nine kinds of dwelling places, abandoning of the hindrances, development of meditation, attainment of jhana and psychic powers, and the various kinds of, the 38 kinds of meditation, until the realization of awakening. And then the 16 parts of anapanasati meditation explained in detail. On a series of gold plates. It's easy enough to do it, easy enough to write that on gold plates. But so,
it's actually plate you eat from, or just a plate?
No, it just means a flat piece of gold.
Sorry, I thought it was like,
so
they could give them to their grandma and put into this display case.
So anyway, so it's quite substantial, isn't it? Right? It's not just a sort of one or two lines or a saying or something like that. I mean, it's a serious and quite extensive summary of the main teachings of the Dhamma, which has interest in its own right as a representation of what a good summary of the Dhamma was supposed to be, right? So in that case, it has its own interest. But also, personally, I mean, whether it's true or not, we have no way of saying. I certainly don't find it particularly implausible. Probably, yeah. Okay, so to come back to, or come to the Dhatavibhanga Sutta itself. As have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was wandering in the Magadhan country and eventually arrived at Rajagaha. So there's no mention of his sort of psychic power journey from Savatthi or anything like that. He went to the potter, Bhagava, and said to him, "If it's not inconvenient for you, Bhagava, I'll stay one night in your workshop." Bhagava said, "It's not inconvenient for me, Bhante, but there is a homeless one already staying there. If he agrees, then stay as long as you like, Venerable Sir." Now there was a clansman named Pukusati who had gone forth from the home life into homelessness, out of faith in the Blessed One, and on that occasion he was already staying in the potter's workshop. Then the Blessed One went to the Venerable Pukusati and said to him, "If it's not inconvenient for you, Bhikkhu, I will stay one night in the workshop." He refers to Pukusati as Bhikkhu, even though he hasn't taken a formal ordination. Oh, no, hang on, it doesn't say that he hasn't taken his formal ordination.
Shaved his head and fell on
the... Yeah. I profess that Dhamma. At the end of it. At the end, interesting, I hadn't noticed that detail before. At the end, then, he asks for the full admission for the Upasampada. Usually people will ask for the Pabbaja Upasampada. So here it seems that he's gone forth, but he hasn't had his Upasampada, so he's a novice. Whether he's actually had the novice under anyone, sorry? Whether he had the novice ordination under anyone, or it doesn't say, or whether he went for just by himself or on his robes. So, anyway, the Buddha refers to him as a bhikkhu. And Pukusati, of course, not recognizing the Buddha, says, "The potter's workshop is large enough, friend." Oops. "Let the Venerable One stay as long as he likes." Just FYI, if the Buddha comes to visit, you don't call him friend, right? Mate. G'day, mate. How's it going?
Does the Buddha complain later on?
No, the Buddha doesn't complain about it, yeah. Then the Blessed One entered the potter's workshop, prepared a spread of grass at one end, and sat down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect, and establishing mindfulness in front of him. So notice the way that this wording is used. When I was doing history of mindfulness, one of the conclusions that I came to in doing that study was that, you know, these days we think of mindfulness. We sometimes think of mindfulness meditation as a particular kind of meditation, and Satipatthana as being, you know, one of the kinds of meditation. Whereas in the suttas, what it says here, it says establishing mindfulness. What it means is doing meditation. It just means that he doesn't mean that he did a particular kind of meditation. He just meant that he sat there in meditation. So to establish mindfulness, i.e. to do Satipatthana, simply means to meditate. The idiom here in front of him is parimukhang. I think what it means is presence. So he established a presence of mindfulness. Then the Blessed One spent most of his night seated in meditation. Venerable Pukkasati also spent most of the night seated in meditation. Then the Blessed One thought, this clansman conducts himself in a way that inspires confidence. Suppose I were to question him. So he asked the Venerable Pukkasati, under whom have you gone forth, Bhikkhu? Who is your teacher? Whose Dhamma do you profess? Friend, there is the recluse Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from the Sakyan clan. Now a good report of that blessed Gotama has been spread to this effect. That blessed one is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed. I've gone forth under that blessed one. That blessed one is my teacher. I profess the Dhamma of that blessed one. But Bhikkhu, where is that blessed one, accomplished and fully enlightened, now living? So the Buddha's kind of playing him along. And there is, friends, a city in the northern country named Savatthi. The blessed one, accomplished and fully enlightened, is now living there.
Mm-hmm. Surely everyone in my village would know about the existence of Savatthi. It seems like it's a huge metropolitan area. Why would someone say, oh, there is such and such city? It's like saying, oh, you know, there's a city named Melbourne. We know about Melbourne. Why would he say it like that?
I don't know. Maybe just an idiom. I don't know.
No, it's like people don't get around much. So.
Yeah.
Pretty sort of localized words.
That's true. Yeah, like, I don't know. It might be just an idiom. Yeah. The Buddha goes on, but Bhikkhu, have you ever seen that blessed one before? Would you recognize him if you saw him? No, friend, I've never seen that blessed one before, nor would I recognize him if I saw him. Then the blessed one thought, this clansman has gone forth from the home life into homelessness under me. Suppose I were to teach him the Dhamma. So the blessed one addressed the Venerable Pukkasati thus, Bhikkhu, I will teach you the Dhamma. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, friend, the Venerable Pukkasati replied. The blessed one said this. So he takes an interesting approach to the teaching. And if, for example, you can compare this approach to the teaching with the approach that the Buddha used when teaching the five ascetics. And when he was teaching the five ascetics, his first order of business was to give them some faith in what he was saying, to sort of to persuade them that he was actually enlightened. And because in that case, presumably, that was what was needed to get them to really listen, to get them to really understand. Whereas with Pukkasati, it would have been very easy for him to convince him from the beginning that he was the Buddha. He already had faith in him, but he didn't. He just taught him the Dhamma, relied on the convincing power of the Dhamma rather than trying to give him a personal faith in the Buddha as such. So it's interesting that different approach that he takes with different people. So as with several of the suttas in this Vibhanga Vagga, the sutta takes the form of giving a summary of a number of topics and then a detailed exposition of them. the form, the Uddesa Vibhanga form. Bhikkhu, this person consists of six elements, six bases of contact, and 18 kinds of mental exploration. And he has four foundations. The tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands upon these foundations. And when the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over him, he is called a sage at peace. One should not neglect wisdom. One should preserve truth. One should cultivate relinquishment, and one should train for peace. This is the summary of the exposition of the six elements. And the Buddha goes on to teach the six all of those teachings in detail. Bhikkhu, this person consists of these six elements. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said? There are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, the air element, the space element, and the consciousness element. So it was said. It was with reference to this that it was said this person consists of six elements. So notice in Buddhism you find sometimes the four elements are mentioned, the earth, water, fire and air. Sometimes the space element is added, and somewhat more rarely also consciousness is added as well, the dhatu. Now, when we're using the word element, then of course we're not meaning element in the sense in modern science of being sort of the elementary table or anything like that. But they're something like fundamental aspects of existence. Earth, water, fire and air, of course, being the basics, also especially earth, water and air being the basic states of matter, solid, liquid and gas. Fire being the energy and the transformation between them. Space in Buddhism is not conceived as being something which exists in and of itself, but is space is merely the product of the other elements. So space is basically the gap in between the other elements. I shouldn't quite say that that's a Buddhist way of looking at it. Actually, the Buddhist schools differed in this. Some Buddhist schools asserted that space did indeed exist in and of itself. Whereas others said it's merely conditioned by the other four elements. Actually, the suttas are fairly clear on that point, that the space element doesn't exist by itself. And that also agrees with the modern physics point of view. Space is not something that exists. Space is conditioned by movement and the presence of the rest of the universe. When you have the big crunch and the whole universe is sucked into a little dot in the center of everything, there's no space. It's not like you have a little dot with space around it. Space is folded up into the dot itself. There's nothing outside of that. And space only emerges when you have the Big Bang and everything explodes outwards. Then the space comes into existence. So space, in other words, space is conditioned. Some of the Buddhist schools did assert that space was unconditioned, which is actually a view you find in, similar to views you find in the Upanishads. And I'll go on a little bit before looking at the comparative study. The next paragraph, Bhikkhu, this person consists of six bases of contact. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said? There are the base of eye contact, ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, and mind contact. So it was with reference to this that it was said, Bhikkhu, this person consists of six bases of contact. And this person consists of 18 kinds of mental exploration. So it was said, with reference to what was this said? On seeing a form with the eye, one explores a form productive of joy, one explores a form productive of grief, one explores a form productive of equanimity. Similarly, with the ear, with the nose, with the tongue, with the body, and with the mind, one explores a mind object, a dhamma, productive of joy, of grief, or of equanimity. So it was with reference to this that it was said, Bhikkhu, this person consists of 18 kinds of mental exploration. And these being all dhammas that we've looked at in recent weeks in some of the suttas we've looked at. I'll now just go over to look at the comparative study and to see how we stand with reference to the Chinese and Tibetan versions. So all of the different versions begin in the same way, saying the Buddha went to the house of the potter in Rajagaha and asked permission to stay. The individual translation, which is the oldest Chinese version, precedes that event with a narrative that gives some background to Pukkhusati, the person whom the Buddha met in the potter's place, and a background which is found similar to that found in the Pali commentary and also in a Chinese Dhammapada Avadana collection. So the Chinese Dhammapada Avadana collection, we have the translation of that. So that would be interesting to have a look at that in more detail. With some variations, the individual translation of Pali commentary and the Chinese Dhammapada collection report that Pukkhusati had been a king and a friend of King Bimbisara who had informed Pukkhusati of the appearance of the Buddha and his teaching. This had inspired Pukkhusati so much that he decided to go forth on his own with the intention of approaching the Buddha to become his disciple. The Dhatavibhanga Sutta and its parallels agree that Pukkhusati, who was already residing at the potter's place, readily agreed to share the place with the Buddha, whom he did not recognize. The four versions describe in similar terms that the two spent most of the night in meditation. After this, a conversation began during which the Buddha found out that Pukkhusati had gone forth on his account. Without revealing his identity, the Buddha then decided to give Pukkhusati a teaching. So the background story pretty much the same in all the versions, and interestingly enough that the story found in the Pali commentary is also shared in the northern traditions, both in the Chinese Dhammapada, and also in the one of the individual translations. And so this is a phenomenon which you find fairly commonly, that it's not just the early canonical or sutta material which is shared between the traditions, but much of the later versions, Jataka stories and all of these kinds of things can be shared as well. However, when you look closely at them, they're not always shared in the same way, and there's less sharing than with the early material. So with the early material, almost all of it is shared. With the later material, some of it's shared and some of it isn't. But you also find that the manner in which it's shared is also can be quite different. And so this particular example shows a good example of that, whereas in the Pali you have the story, it's been included in the commentary on the sutta. In the early Chinese translated sutta, it's included in the sutta itself. Okay? So given the nature of the oral tradition in India, you can understand that it would be very easy for the background story, there's kind of fluidity between how much material is in the background story and how much is actually included in the sutta. And you find this quite commonly with suttas that have a strong narrative element, that they'll include more or less degrees of it in the text itself. And also another version found in a completely different text as a background story for a Dhammapada verse. And again, as you find in the Pali collections of Dhammapadas and the Jatakas, that you'll find that some of them will be associated with particular incidents in the suttas or the Vinaya, and the Dhammapada collections will typically give a more kind of popular retelling of the story, with the emphasis on the kind of the human interest and psychic power kind of aspect of things, rather than the philosophical. So that presentation can be brought in a number of ways. Typically, one of the differences you find between the Pali tradition and the northern traditions, and this is only a tendency, but it is something that you find, is that because the Pali tradition preserves such a strong commentarial tradition, that what they tended to do, and it's only a tendency, but they tended to do, was to preserve the later material in the commentaries separate from the canon, whereas there's a tendency in some of the other collections to incorporate the later strata of material in the text itself. So in this case, you see that one of the Chinese translations actually includes his background story in the canonical text, whereas in the Pali it's in the commentary, and that situation is far from unique. That particular point actually was the crux of a controversy in Buddhist studies a number of years ago, where Gregory Chopin was trying to, on his usual bent of trying to prove that the Pali Canon was late and inauthentic and no more authentic than anything else, and so on and so forth, and talked about an incident with regarding an offering at a stupa at Toyika, and that incident is found in a number of places through different vineyards and traditions and so on, and he argued that it was found in a similar way in the Pali texts, and because it was a teaching about stupas, one of the foundational arguments in early Buddhist studies was that stupas are virtually not mentioned or very little mentioned in the Pali Vinaya, and they're much more mentioned in other vinayas, stupas and the worship of relics. And this was one of the reasons given by the early Buddhist studies people for thinking that the Pali Vinaya was somewhat earlier than the other vinayas. So Gregory Chopin made this kind of big song and dance about this and made this big argument, only it was pointed out later that the story from the Pali was actually quoting from the Pali commentary and not from the Vinaya itself, a fact which he didn't emphasize very clearly in his essay. So as often with Chopin's argument, rather than proving his point, it actually, if you look at the text as they are, it actually proved the initial point, which is that the Pali keeps the later material in the commentaries and not in the canon.
Why do you believe that the writing is possible in the Buddhist time when they have to record everything in the oral tradition?
Well, they recorded the religious scriptures in oral tradition. Doesn't mean they recorded everything else in oral tradition.
Yeah, so why didn't they just write
that? Right, the scriptures?
Yeah.
Oh, lots of reasons. Okay, so, well, just to come back to the question of writing, I'll just give a bit of background for that. There's no particular evidence one way or the other as to whether writing existed in the time of the Buddha. There's no concrete evidence one way or the other. We know obviously that writing existed not long afterwards because of the Ashokan pillars, say 150 years afterwards or so on. But the Ashokan pillars, while they are obviously evidence for writing, are also evidence that writing was somewhat primitive. The script used in the Ashokan pillars was not all that highly evolved. So there's not much evidence for writing in the time of the Buddha. There have subsequently been a few possible findings of pottery with inscriptions on it, dating from around the time of the Buddha, from India and possibly from Sri Lanka. I've read about these things, and I've talked with the people in the departments who were present when this thing was discussed, and it seems to be a bit uncertain. But there's certainly a possibility that that's there. Writing is probably mentioned in the Mahasilas in the Digha Nikaya. It talks about a child's game of guessing at letters. The wording's a little bit obscure, but that seems to be what it means. And writing's also clearly mentioned in the Bhikkhuni Vinaya, where it allows writing materials for bhikkhunis. Of course, the Bhikkhuni Vinaya as such is often, probably somewhat later date than the Bhikkhu Vinaya. So the fact that it's mentioned in the Bhikkhuni Vinaya doesn't necessarily mean it was dated from the Buddha's time. So there are some bits of evidence. You also find, of course, the Jatakas mentioned writing fairly matter-of-factly and fairly frequently for personal communications. So taking all of that together, I think it's most likely that there was writing around the place, that it was probably used reasonably freely for personal communications, for trade, and for governance. One of the limitations which they had for writing at the time was that they didn't have the palm leaf manuscripts. So writing is always written just on a leaf. They didn't have anything better than that. So obviously it's very limited what you can actually put on it, unless you're a king and you can afford gold plates. Then there's not that much you can write on a leaf, right? So what can you write on a leaf? Well, if you've got a few leaves, you can write, in this caravan there's 16 camels and 3 bales of straw and 16 bags of rice and so on and so forth, and make sure that they're all there, so it's an inventory, so when it arrives at the other end they can check it. Yeah, so that kind of thing you can write fairly easily. If you look in other places, in Mesopotamia for example, there are thousands and thousands of clay tablets that have exactly that kind of thing written on them, dating from before the time of the Buddha. This is one of the most disappointing things about ancient writings, is that a lot of it is like really, really boring. And of course in Mesopotamia, as they're using clay, then of course it survives. You have thousands of these things. It has the interest. You can analyze the economy at the time and the changes in, you know, camels and goats and sheep and stuff if you're interested, but yeah, it's somewhat boring. So that kind of thing would have been written, I think, but there's not really strong evidence for it. The reason for not writing down religious scriptures, well, first of all, religious scriptures are a lot longer, so you can't really write them very well on leaves. Leaves are also very impermanent. Why are you writing it down, right? Yeah, fine, write it down on a leaf so that, you know, 3 months later when they reach their destination, they can read it, no problem, you know. A king wants to write a message to his minister in a border town, give it to a horse rider so they can take it and then they can read it a few days later, no problems, yeah. But for preserving text over a long period of time, large amounts of text over a long period of time, writing would not nearly have compared with the oral tradition. So that's one problem with it. Second, that's purely a practical problem, and that was solved, of course, when they developed the technology for the birch bark manuscripts in the north and the palm leaf manuscripts in the south, which were both sort of flat and sort of consistent enough to be able to write extensive texts on, and also durable enough to be able to last for a considerable period of time. And that seems that happened a few hundred years later, and probably as a result of increased trade and connections with the West after the time of King Ashoka, and the increased demands on administration, trade and so on at that time was probably spurred the development of a sort of native writing technologies. The other thing, of course, is the precedent. All of the religious scriptures in India had always been learnt off by heart. Nobody would have really thought of doing it any other way. Yeah. And finally, well, learning that stuff off by heart is good. You know it off by heart. Yeah. So I think it's, you know, why would you, if you write it down, once you've written it down, this is an absolute crux in human history. As soon as you write stuff down, you don't have to bother about it anymore. I mean, that's what you see every Buddhist monastery you go to. You don't bother studying the suttas. I mean, they're all there in the cabinet. Why bother, right? So we have, we've got the Tripitaka here, yeah. So you don't, if you have it in your heart, it's actually in your heart. So, it's much better than having it written down. Does that answer the question? Sort of, right? Excellent. Okay.
Wasn't there a belief that there needed to be a guard put upon what was taught?
A guard put upon what was taught?
Mm-hmm. It becomes at least difficult to learn what they had to teach.
Well,
publicized it, and it was kind of considered like disrespectful to one's own teaching.
Well, you find that in the Brahmins, of course, yeah, and that's very strong. You know, if a Sudra listens to the Vedas, they need to have molten brass poured in their ears. So, yeah, that was that. But you don't find that idea in Buddhism.
Well, not to teach the the recitation of the Dhamma, word by word, the lay person is one of the lay
rules. Yeah, I always find that one very strange. I don't know what that rule means. I don't know why that rule is there. As a generalist speaking, I mean, we know that the Buddha was teaching all the time to everyone. I mean, there wasn't any restrictions on the teaching. The Buddha never said, don't teach this to lay people or anything like that. You have the Itivuttaka is memorized by all the lay people. And, you know, you constantly find, you know, people learning stuff. There's, you know, one isolated vinaya rule of somewhat dubious interpretation doesn't sort of counteract the thousands of suttas where the Buddha's just teaching openly and not making any restriction about who he's teaching to.
Because of that rule, I thought there was a difference between just teaching it versus on one occasion. Blessed One said that, well, you know, getting somebody up on the mnemonics and the repetition, getting to where they could turn around and teach it to the next person.
Yeah, I mean, maybe something like that. Yeah, I mean, I know what you mean, and yes, I mean, in that vinaya rule obviously has something to do with that.
Once you've got it in writing, then you no longer have that.
But I understand that the point that you're making, but it's still, I've never understood what that's doing, because we know that people were learning and memorizing texts all over the place. So I honestly don't really know why that's there. Even though obviously it's referring to something about something like that. But I don't exactly know really what it meant.
Well, doesn't the rule say recited on the line by line, or recited together, or something like that?
It does.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean you don't have to teach them. It's just when you recite with them, something like that.
Yeah, even so, yeah. What's the problem? I mean, I've read and studied that rule for years, and you know, at the end of the day, I don't understand it. And it's one of those things which I think probably has a lost context. I think it probably had a meaning which we don't really get. That's my conclusion with that. Okay.
Maybe Buddhism doesn't have anything to hide. There's no secret teachings like in the Dharma Nikko.
That's right.
Yeah. Really kind of, they have the copyright on, we do the rituals and we're the only ones who know how to do it. That's why you can charge your money for it. Whereas the Buddha said, like, oh, you know, there is no such magical thing that only the some certain special people are allowed to know, and everybody else isn't.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's what he said in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Because
anyone can understand voice, but only a very few who don't understand writing.
That's also true, yeah. Yeah. I mean, these things they only kind of emerge when there's a whole series of cultural conditions which are ready for it. You know, there has to be the technology has to be ready, the willingness has to be ready, the need has to be ready. All of those things have to be there in order to make that. And it's just those conditions weren't ready at the time of the Buddha. I bet you anything that when they first wrote down the scriptures, that all of the old monks are going, this is the end of Buddhism now. Remember, I was a young monk, we didn't just write the things down, we had to learn them, had to sit down. We used to practice chanting 6 hours a day. 6 hours a day! Oh, we were lucky if we were doing it 6 hours a day. Okay, moving on. This person has four foundations. So it was said. Okay, sorry. Sorry. I've got to go on with the comparative study. Teaching in all versions begins by mentioning the six elements, six types of contact, the 18 times of mental exploration based on these contacts. The four versions continually by briefly presenting four maxims, after which they turn to a more detailed analysis of the elements mentioned earlier. Okay, so basically all of this is pretty much identical in all the four versions. So four foundations. One should not neglect wisdom, one should preserve truth, one should cultivate relinquishment, and one should train for peace. Okay, so one should not neglect wisdom, one should preserve truth, one should cultivate relinquishment, and one should train for peace. How do you not neglect wisdom? So notice how he's introducing this particular teaching in the beginning, in the summary. It doesn't seem like this teaching has anything to do with the former teaching on the four elements. But now that we're going to see that, on the six elements. But now we're going to see that the Buddha, in fact, by teaching the six elements, was like laying the groundwork. He's introducing the theme, and now he's going to, and that's a matter of kind of building it up piece by piece. He's giving the groundwork for understanding, and now he's going to go deeper into this practice of understanding wisdom. Now, interesting also to see that the Buddha's teaching Pukkhasati directly at a level of wisdom. So he's directly teaching him Vipassana meditation. And presumably, as they were sitting up meditation all night together, he's already checked out his samadhi, and he says, right, nothing to be taught there. His meditation, his samadhi's already good. So what we need to do is to teach wisdom. So the earth element. So how does one not neglect wisdom? There are the six elements: earth element, water element, fire element, air element, space element, and consciousness element. What is the earth element? The earth element may be either internal or external. Adhyatang bahidha. So notice this usage. This is how you find in the Satipatthana Sutta and other places. Contemplates internally, contemplates externally, contemplates internally, externally. This is what it's talking about. What is the internal earth element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and clung to. Clung to is a technical term, upadina, which is used to mean karmically acquired. In other words, it's the earth element which is given rise to because you've got born and you've got yourself a body. Yeah, so this is what clung to means, because you've got it because of your clinging and grasping. That is, head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrows, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, large intestines, small intestines, contents of the stomach, feces, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and clung to. This is called the internal earth element. Now, both the internal earth element and the external earth element are simply earth element. And this should be seen as it is with proper wisdom. Thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the earth element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the earth element. So here it doesn't define the external earth element. Obviously the external earth element referring to the earth and the trees and the solid things around us. So notice how the movement of the reflection here from looking inside, seeing and understanding one's own, that those solid parts of one's own body, then comparing with the external element and then dissolving the differences between them, they're just earth element. And this is exactly the procedure which is taught in the Satipatthana Sutta. You contemplate internally, contemplate internally, externally. In other words, you see that the internal and external are not really different.
I'm not even sure this point matters, but I've sometimes seen like earth element or any of the elements translated as quality of fluidity versus the actual stuff, but it sounds like here is the actual solid stuff.
Yeah, no, it doesn't mean solid stuff. Quality is not a bad translation. Property.
So it's the property of the head hairs, but the solidity of the head hairs.
Right. Yeah. So whatever is solid, solidified, and clung to, it doesn't clearly make that distinction. Right. So it refers to, you know, the earth element is referring to these solid things, but it's also quite clearly it means the actual solidity of it. And that's something which is discussed more explicitly in the commentaries in the Abhidhamma. It makes that point more explicitly. Yeah. So these are like examples of the earth element. according to the Abhidhamma, basically all matter has the four elements in it. So even if you have like a rock as a kind of paradigm of the earth element, but the rock actually has water and air and space and heat in it, but whichever one predominates. Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So, okay. So you see this as it properly is with proper wisdom. Thus, this is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Okay. So you're breaking down. Normally, we have this physical stuff in here, which I'm clinging to, okay, the organic matter, and this is something which is quite different from that stuff there. So, you know, if I get dirty, there's something wrong, right? Because I've got that earth over there, then it's touching my earth here, and that's like icky earth, and this is good earth. So we make this kind of, we're attached to some of it, but actually it's just earth. So go and play in the mud, who cares? So you sort of dissolve these differences, and then you're not attached to the earth element. You realize how absurd it is to be just so attached to just a physical property. What bhikkhu is the water element? The water element may be either internal or external. What's the internal water element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is water, watery, and clung to, upadina, that is bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spit, snot, oil of the joints, urine, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is water, watery, and clung to. This is called the internal element. Now, both the internal element and internal water element and external water element are simply water elements. And that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom. Thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the water element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the water element. Just to sort of note with the translation here, it doesn't actually say makes the mind dispassionate, it just says that the mind dispassions towards the water element.
Much better.
Virajeti, I think. What bhikkhu is the fire element? The fire element may either be internal or external. What's the internal fire element? Whatever internally belongs to oneself is fire, fiery, and clung to. That is, that by which one is warmed, ages, and is consumed. So we were discussing this the other day, how in cold climates people live for longer. So the fire element is the element of aging. And it's got to make sense, doesn't it? Yeah, you put stuff in the fridge to keep it longer, right? Take the fire element out, doesn't age. Things move slowly. That's basically what heat is from a physical point of view, is motion, right? So things move faster. That's what aging is, moving faster. Live fast, die young. Sorry?
It doesn't say
that
in the text.
No, I just made that one up. Okay, so it's consumed, and that by which what is eaten, drunk, consumed, and tasted gets completely digested. Okay, so the heat of digestion. Or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is fire, fiery, and clung to. This is called the internal fire element. Now, both the internal fire element and the external fire element are simply fire element. That should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the fire element, makes the mind dispassionate towards the fire element. So what's the earth element? The air element may be either... Sorry, what's the air element? The air element may be either internal or external. What's the internal air element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is air, airy, and clung to. That is upgoing winds, right? Burps, downgoing winds, the other thing. Winds in the belly, winds in the bowels, winds that course through the limbs.
Like the oxygen in your blood?
Maybe. Oh, but it's usually interpreted as being like energies. Actually, even in the Upanishads, it's got quite a lot of detail about all the different kinds of breath, the apana and udana and pana and all the other ones. And the in-breath and out-breath being the most obvious example. Whatever else internally belonging to oneself is air, airy, and clung to. This is called the internal air element. Now, both the internal air element and the external air element are simply air element. And that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the air element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the air element. Oops. And what's the space element? The space element may either be internal or external. What's the internal space element? The space inside your skull, no, whatever is internally belongs to oneself, the space special clung to, that is the holes of the ears, the nostrils, the door of the mouth, and that where by what is eaten, drunk, consumed and tasted gets swallowed, and where it collects and where it's excreted from below, so the space in the digestive tract. Whatever else internally belonging to oneself is space, spatial, and clung to. This is called the internal space element. Now, both the internal space element and the external space element are simply space element, and that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the space element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the space element. So much for the five material elements, yeah, the Patavi, Apo, Vayo, Tejo, and Akasa Dhatu. And then goes on to my favorite passage is talking about the consciousness element. Then there remains only consciousness purified and bright. What does one cognize with that consciousness? One cognizes this is pleasant. One cognizes this is painful. One cognizes this is neither painful nor pleasant. In dependence on a contact to be felt as pleasant, there arises a pleasant feeling. When one feels a pleasant feeling, one understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. One understands with the cessation of that same contact to be felt as pleasant, its corresponding feeling, the pleasant feeling that arose in dependence on that contact to be felt as pleasant, ceases and subsides. In dependence on a contact to be felt as painful, there arises a painful feeling. When one feels a painful feeling, one understands, I feel a painful feeling. One understands with the cessation of that same contact to be felt as painful, its corresponding feeling, the painful feeling that arose in dependence on that contact to be felt as painful, ceases and subsides. In dependence on a contact to be felt as neither painful nor pleasant, there arises a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. When one feels a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, one understands, I feel a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. One understands with the cessation of that same contact to be felt as neither painful nor pleasant. Its corresponding feeling ceases and subsides. Because just as from the contact and friction of two fire sticks, heat is generated and fire is produced, and with the separation and disjunction of those two fire sticks, the corresponding heat ceases and subsides, so too, in dependence on a contact to be felt as pleasant as painful, or neither painful or pleasant, there arises the appropriate feeling, and then one understands with the cessation of that contact, the corresponding feeling ceases and subsides. So here's this passage talking about consciousness. So we're now talking about the mind, not just about the physicality of things. Now notice how this, as with the previous one, it invokes or builds on the themes which are introduced in the beginning, which originally appeared to be a separate theme, and is now building on that. The idea of the contact to be felt as pleasant is related to the different kinds of mental exploration. Now, one of the things that's going on here, clearly, is that we're getting instructions in Vipassana meditation. Yeah? And as I said before, they've already met, he's already gone forth and purified his sila, he's already been sitting meditation all night with the Buddha, so he's got his samadhi, he's good. So Pukkasati's been taught on vipassana. He's been taught the basis of vipassana, mindfulness, awareness of the body, investigation of the elements, seeing through the elements as being not self. Now, then there remains only consciousness purified and bright. So this is very, obviously a very interesting phrase, and the Buddha talked about this mind which is purified and bright in a number of contexts. But generally speaking, he always talked about it in the context of samadhi. Okay, so here's the phrase in Pali: Ataparang vinyanang yeva avasisati parisuddhang pariyodatang. And then there remains only consciousness. So yeva vinyana avasisati, it's left over. Parisuddhang pariyodatang, purified and bright. So this is very similar to the passage describing the mind or the citta at the end of the experience of fourth jhana. Sorry?
It is very interesting.
It is, yeah.
Because
Right.
On the projection.
Right.
And what did that achieve? Knowing mind.
Right.
And here is that variety. A shankar purifies and shining. Here any substance,
Any what, sir?
Any substance.
Substance?
Substance.
Substance. Oh, is there any substance there? No.
Well, if you say no or yes, it depends.
Yeah. Well, I think in the I mean, that to me, that's that very question is answered in the next sentence.
The ontology,
yeah. Yeah, exactly, and that's why I think if you look at the next sentence, tena cha vijnanena kim vijanati. Yeah. So by what? What is cognized by that consciousness? So as always, it's the consciousness is the function of being aware. It's not an actual. It's not a thing. It's not a
solid entity. So it's always aware whatever happens, it knows. That means it always is there. That's your question, Samadhi
Vara. But that's like saying if is the color white always clean? Well, yeah, it is, because you've defined white as being clean.
It's always there, you need to recover it, how you throw it.
Yeah. In this particular context, I think it's important to bear in mind. I think one of the things that you find in some of those philosophical discussions about consciousness in later Buddhism is that they ignore the fact that the original teaching was actually specifically given in the context of meditation, as in this context, and as, for example, the famous the Pabhasara Citta context, which also talks about Citta Bhavana. So this is obviously talking about the purified and bright mind, which is remaining in meditation.
Because it doesn't shine yet, it is there, and we need to be covered by meditation. Or it is polluted by meditation. It's not sure, isn't it? So either way,
I mean, it's not Yeah, but to me it seems fairly clear that that's what the intent is. I mean, you're right in the sense it could be interpreted ambiguously, but fairly obvious, surely, that it's actually about a practice of meditation and quite an advanced practice of vipassana meditation. He's just led him through this vipassana into the not self in the five elements. They've just been sitting meditation all night. And at the end of it, we know that he became an anagami, so he's obviously like very advanced in his meditation.
Become Sotavanna or Anagami or Arahant is not the question here. But I remember when I meditate and come to each state already, only continent, Brahma and Pru, and now whatever happened. But what next?
Uh-huh.
Yes, that question made me like think you're actually cannot progress after that.
Well, let's continue with the sutta, and maybe the Dhatarubhanga Sutta will answer your questions. It's an idiom in the suttas that they will often treat the four elements almost as if they're a shorthand or reference to the four jhanas. So, for example, the four elements, and then after that, the formless attainments. I'm not necessarily suggesting that that's the case in this particular case, but it seems to me very likely that this is talking about the insight based on the jhanas or samadhi which he's had previously, and then he's developed the insight into the five physical elements. What's left? Vijnana Yeva is a little bit ambiguous. The commentary opts for a somewhat mundane explanation of that, opting to say that what it means is that all that's left to investigate by means of insight meditation. Right? So it's not saying that only consciousness remains, it's just saying that consciousness is the only subject which still needs to be investigated. So this is one interpretation, although I do think, to be honest, I do think that probably it has something to do more with the kind of meditation experience that Dhammananda was talking about earlier, where when you're in meditation and you practice and you let go through seeing not self in these elements and things like that, then they just drop away and all you perceive is consciousness. With that consciousness, one is then investigating and understanding so very clearly and distinctly the different kinds of contact as they give rise to different kinds of feelings. Pleasant feeling, painful, and neutral feeling. So that consciousness itself is used as the basis for, that consciousness which is in pure and bright is not regarded as kind of sort of a goal of Buddhist practice. It's regarded as a tool of Buddhist practice for investigating, well, what is the nature of experience? So, I said, you had a question earlier?
Oh, it's been covered.
So let's go have a look further and see what goes on. So this is one of the suttas. It gets more and more interesting as it goes further. And then it says, then there remains only equanimity, purified and bright, malleable, wieldy and radiant. So here it's referring to equanimity, upekkha, purified and bright, malleable, wieldy and radiant. So the upekkha is even better than the vijnana we had beforehand. That was only malleable, that was only bright and purified. And now we've got the upekkha, which is even better. Avasisati parisuddha pariodata, purified and bright, mudu, malleable, gentle, gamanya, workable, wieldy, pabhasaracha, shining, yeah. And of course this also sounds very similar to the standard description of the mind in after it's emerged from fourth jhana. ready to go and develop the higher knowledges, and mudu bhute kamaniye anangane mudu, and so on and so forth. So without doubt this is referring to the equanimity of the fourth jhana here. Yeah, I think it's referring to insight based on that. I mean, there's an association between these passages and the jhanas, yeah? It's clearly not divorced from it. So I interpret it as being insight meditation, which is done in the context of doing jhana practice.
But at that level, would you still be feeling unpleasant?
Well, after you emerge from the jhanas, yeah. Yeah. This one is after fourth jhana, yeah.
It's interesting that fourth jhana is kept by the absence of the Sukha Dukkha and Adukkha and Sukha.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Or three jhanas of Esos. Not necessarily, but it's sort of...
Suha...
we mentioned previously.
Yeah, it is. That's an interesting correlation, yeah. I mean, I think with the three jhanas, the first three jhanas, even though you don't have the Dukkha in them, the very fact that you have Sukha, well... Dukkha is kind of implied, isn't
right.
it? It's kind of part of that binary. Yeah.
Right, the secret of Dukkha.
Yeah.
Can I ask what Dukkha's suffering or discontent?
Suffering.
What's the other one?
Sukha. Yeah, that's the other thing.
What's happiness? I'm never worried about that one.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I mean, there's a number of implications about this whole kind of thing. I mean, one of the things is you know, seeing the... If we're understanding this vipassana meditation as vipassana usually is, as something which emerges from the practice of samadhi and the practice of jhanas, then you've already immersed yourself very deeply in that sukha, in that blissful feeling of jhanas. And then you're ready to fully accept and fully understand the painful and the neutral feelings and all of those kinds of things. So it's quite a different point of view than, you know, coming along and saying, well, I feel full of anxiety and stress and I feel scattered and I don't know what I'm doing. Or just watch the distress, watch the anxiety, right? So when vipassana is taught as a psychotherapy tool, just it's good to be aware that it's quite a different kind of thing than what the Buddha is teaching here. He's not saying to somebody who's suffering from distress, well, be mindful of your distress. Right? He's saying to somebody who's extremely integrated and full of bliss and peace, look at the suffering. Okay, then there remains only equanimity, purified and bright, malleable, wieldy and radiant. Suppose, Bhikkhu, a skilled goldsmith or his apprentice were to prepare a furnace, heat up the crucible, take some gold with tongs and put it in the crucible. Presumably this would have been a fairly common sight at the time. From time to time he would blow on it, from time to time he would sprinkle water over it, and from time to time he'd just look on. That gold would become refined, well refined, completely refined, faultless, rid of dross, malleable, wieldy and radiant. Then whatever kind of ornament he wished to make from it, whether a gold chain or earrings or a necklace or a golden garland, it would suit his purpose. So too, Bhikkhu, there remains only equanimity, purified and bright, malleable, wieldy and radiant. He understands thus, if I was to direct this equanimity, so purified and bright, to the base of infinite space and to develop my mind accordingly, then this equanimity of mind, supported by that base, clinging to it, would remain for a very long time. If I was to direct this equanimity, so purified and bright, to the base of infinite consciousness, base of nothingness, base of neither perception nor non-perception, and to develop my mind accordingly, then this equanimity of mind supported by that base, clinging to it, would remain for a very long time. Okay.
The commentary says that means a long time means that if he died in that state, he'd be reborn in the plane of infinite space and so forth.
Right.
And be there for, you know, thousands and thousands of eons. Is that
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Really? Yeah.
I just thought it ended up, like, be there another hour or two.
No. Okay, we'll come to that in a sec. But it's a good point, good question, and it's one of those points where the Pali is probably a bit clearer than the translation. If I was to upasanghareyam, apply my mind, interesting use of that. So if I was to chittang bhaveyam, develop my mind accordingly, just notice the usage of chitta bhavana in this case. Chitta bhavana, meditation, here meaning developing the mind in the formless attainments. So if I was dependent, nisita, and so if this equanimity was dependent and grasping, upadana, yeah, so upadana, of course, one of the classic word for what's leading to rebirth. So if I was grasping onto that leading to rebirth, then the mind would remain chirang dighamadhanam. Chirang dighamadhanam. So both of those words meaning a long, long period of time. Long, long time, yeah, and it's quite emphatic. Yeah, both of them mean long. And together, kind of long, long time. I'm just seeing if there's any. I'm seeing if there's any other examples of that that might give a sort of random.
It's like in the devotional chant, which is Chira Parinibbutopi.
Chira Parin. Exactly, that's one example of Chira Parinibbutopi. Is the Buddha has passed away long ago. Let's see some other examples. Okay, so this is from the Aganya Sutta, and it says that Vaseta, then those beings who are reborn take birth, then they live on the they live on the mushrooms or the fungus or something on the earth. And then they stay like that for a long, long time. So, chirang digma digma dhanang atangsu. It's basically exactly the same phrase. I don't even know what site this is. I'm seeing this up in Pali. Oh, pretty good. Huh. Oh, this one's from the same one. Yeah. So this one again from the Aganya Sutta, when those beings remain this is talking about the beginning of the Aganya Sutta, those beings reborn in the Abhasara Brahma realm, there they stay made of mind, feeding on joy, self-luminous, moving through the air and glorious. And they remain like that, chirang digamadhanam, for a long, long time. So this is the kind of context that we have for chirang digamadhanam, a long, long time. So it's clearly not talking about sitting in meditation for a few hours. It's talking about something a bit more substantial than that. So this is one of those cases where it's quite a common situation where I'm just trying to find the text again. Where when we have the modernist readings of the suttas and these kinds of things, and the people who try to take rebirth out of the suttas and all of that kind of thing, and they can leverage ambiguities in these kind of texts to make it sound like they're just sitting in meditation for a long time. Whereas actually, if you look closely at the Pali and how it's used in context and how the words are used, clearly it's talking about getting reborn in that particular state. Remembering that this is also pretty much the same place that the Buddha was at before he was enlightened, when he was practicing with his former teachers, and he decided that those practices only led to rebirth in the realm of infinite of nothingness and so on. So then one continues with the reflection. If I were to direct this equanimity so purified and bright to the base of infinite space and develop it accordingly, this would be conditioned, sankatam. If I was to develop to direct it to the base of infinite consciousness or nothingness or neither perception nor non-perception, this would be conditioned. He does not form any condition or generate any volition tending to either being or non-being. Alright? So this is a kind of reflection, a very kind of advanced level of vipassana. It rarely talks very kind of very directly about this kind of level. Sankatam etam, this is conditioned. So neva tang abhi sankaroti, he doesn't abhi sankara it. Again, notice use of the word sankara as in dependent origination, where like in the current context, sankara is the force which leads to consciousness taking rebirth in a particular realm. Na abhi sanchetayati. Yeah? Abhi sanchetayati from the root chetana. And as always, sankara and chetana, or as usual, sankara and chetana are synonyms. So he doesn't make a rebirth aspiration or a wish or an intention for existence, bhavaya, va, vibhavaya, va, for existence or non-existence. So not aspiring or intending for existence or non-existence, he does not grasp at anything in the world. Nakimchi loke upadiyati. Not grasping, he doesn't fret. He doesn't have anxiety. He doesn't have angst. There was the word paritasana, Bhikkhu Bodhi once, and they say, he said this is the closest that you'd have to the English word angst. A paritasang pachatan yeva parinibhayati. Not being anxious. Pachatan yeva, personally, right there inside himself, he cools down. Kiyana jati, rebirth is ended. Vusitang brahmacharyang, the holy life has been lived. Katang karaniyang, done is what should be done. Naparang itataya, not coming back to any state of rebirth. Dipadyanati. Again, the word itata being another one of these words which easily interpreted to just to refer to thusness, or suchness, or this state, or something like that is what it literally means. But when you see it used in context in the suttas, for example, Mahanidhana Sutta, then it's clearly talking about one of the states of rebirth. So, again, I find this a very beautiful and very interesting passage on the higher levels of developing insight through letting go of any volition or condition or intention. There's some interesting notes on this. Venerable Anadio has a note on that particular passage. He did. I'll just come back to the comparative study for a moment. Okay, so coming back to the five physical elements, these are all similar in all of them, the element of consciousness, the discussion of painful, pleasant, neutral feelings, and the contact, these are also similar in all the versions, and the dependence on the kinds of feeling with the comparison with the image of sticks making a fire is also found in the parallel versions. The Dhatavibhanga Sutta and the parallels then go on to describe the equanimity to be attained by attaining the immaterial spheres, which they compare to a goldsmith who refines gold until it's pure and wieldy. And again, the parallels also agree in going beyond all of those things. So basically, up to the point we've had now, there's no significant differences between the two that Analia is noticing here. Now, the reason I'm hesitating is because I read earlier Analia's draft essay on this particular sutta, and he made some interesting points in the draft essay, which it looks like he's omitted in the final version. I can't find it, and I'm not sure why that is, whether he's decided that he was mistaken earlier or whether he just thought it was too much space. But the interesting part was the discussion about bhavayava vibhavayava, coming to any about getting to either being or non-being, existence or non-existence. Doesn't generate any condition towards existence or non-existence. In the draft of this essay, he noted that that phrase is not mentioned in the parallel versions, I think, if I remember correctly. And he goes on to discuss it and by saying that this idea that he's making an aspiration for non-existence, there's actually a passage in the Brahmajala Sutta where it talks about a particular class of meditators who practice the formless attainments apparently with the goal of annihilation. So there's a kind of Buddhism, of course, divides people's ideas about rebirth into eternalism and annihilationism. And usually we think that eternalism means, you know, you believe that there's a soul, you're going to go to an eternal life and so on. And that's a kind of a religious perspective, and then there's the kind of the worldly or materialist perspective that says we're just a body, and then when we die there's going to be nothing left. And that's obviously the most common forms of eternalism and annihilationism. But in the Brahmajala Sutta, and perhaps in one or two other places in the suttas, we find mention of these annihilationists who seem to develop the formless attainments not because they believe that at the end of their life they're just going to be nothing and they're going to go back to the elements and be annihilated that way, but they believe that annihilation is actually the goal that they should be aiming for, and that they'll only get there if they develop these formless attainments. So in other words, they develop the formless attainment not to get reborn in an infinite heaven realm, but in order to extinguish themselves. And so Bhikkhu Bodhi has earlier suggested that this is the case. Other people have argued for it as well. And so there seems to be something to this idea that some of the yogis were actually practicing for the goal of annihilation. And if that reading of it's correct, it's kind of interesting that there's one or two places where the Buddha said that that's like the highest goal of the of those in other sects. That's like the best that it gets. So the difference between what they're doing there, of course, and what Buddhism does is subtle, but of course the basic difference is what they're doing is they're still attached to and trying to attain a state of annihilating themselves, whereas from a Buddhist point of view, you're letting go. So you're not trying to be annihilated or trying to not be annihilated. In fact, that's what it says. You're not making any volition or any aspiration. You're not trying to be reborn or not born or anything like that. You're just purely letting go.
Seems strong that you try to be annihilated through clinging to the state.
Right. Yeah. So, we're getting on. Time's moving along, and you guys have been sitting for a long time and stuff, and I'm on a comfy chair, so I'm fine. But I'm just conscious that we still have a reasonable amount of the sutta to go. So should we continue to the end of the sutta, or should we have a break for tea?
Continue after.
Yeah, what do you think?
Take a break.
Yeah?
Continue afterwards.
Yeah?